cliffcentral.com.
Yes, it is Lemon from U2, and a song I haven't heard in ages. I saw it on the playlist and thought, yes, that could be nice. I've got mixed feelings now that I've actually heard the thing. Might have been able to do without it.
Yeah, I think it's their Fine Young Cannibals moment.
Yeah, it was. That's exactly what that sounds like.
Lemon!
Yeah, very nice. All right, it's just after 7 o'clock and time for the Burning Platform. Every week we get into all the issues that have come up in the week before, some of the ones that may be coming up in the week to come, and we dissect them, look at them, analyze them, fight about them, agree about them, and many other different things, and it's your chance to join us today. The Burning Platform is brought to you by Nando's every single week. This is one of the few places in South Africa where you can join in the conversation, have an opinion, and sometimes get shouted down, but all in good spirits. And this morning, we're joined not only by Canton Pillay, our returning champion. How are you, Canton?
Awesome, as always.
Very good. But we're also joined by Mhlanganisi.
Yep.
Madlongolwana.
It takes a little bit of practice, but well done.
Eventually. Nice to see you, sir. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let me tell you a little bit about Mhlanganisi. He is from Speak Africa Consulting and Activate SA. He has over 6 years' experience in working in issues such as student activism, debate development in the SADC region, and youth development. He works in the Activate Change Drivers Network to help young social entrepreneurs build sustainable organizational models that have an impact throughout South Africa.
Yeah, so, and that's an interestingly old bio, but it's also cool.
Well, would you like to update us? Tell us what you're up
to
now.
I'm a recovering management consultant coming back from about a 5 month sabbatical. So I'm still trying to figure out how to wake up in the morning again. It is a very strange feeling. You know, CEO was calling me this morning. He's like, "Are you okay?" I'm like, "Yes, I am coming."
I've heard of sabbaticals. What are those things?
I don't know what that is.
You play a substantial amount of golf the whole time.
Are you a golfer as well?
I do. Sure. I still shoot off of a 24, but I play off of a 24. But yeah, I played a substantial amount of golf, and then you hang out. You watch a lot of Netflix. I actually realized that I love working class American reality TV. I would never have figured that.
What kinds of shows?
Like the presidential debate.
That was an interesting one last night. But like Yukon Gold is a really interesting on National Geographic. Like watching people mine gold and then finding out how much, and Wicked Tuna. It is the craziest thing. I absolutely love it.
No, I can't watch that stuff. It's too much. But all right. This morning, we're going to talk about a bunch of things that I'm sure both of our guests and you have an interest in. So let's get stuck right into it. We've got to start local. We had the President's State of the Nation address, which we previewed, and we all had an idea of what we thought might come up last week. Some mixed feedback, Canton. Some people thinking that Mark Hayward was victimized horribly in our studio. Other people saying that they loved the fight, and thank God there's a man with the courage of his convictions to have different opinions to Canton.
Exactly. I mean, surely give Mark Hayward some agency. I thought he held his own quite well.
I thought he was good. Anyway, we will be...
And anyway, you know, afterwards, you know, we shook hands, we had a great time, and we said we've got to do this again sometime.
Yeah.
People must just actually recognize that robust debate is very different from actually bludgeoning someone on the streets.
Well, our mutual friend Toby Shapshak called me and said he thought it was a bullying session, and he felt very bad for Mark, and I've invited Toby to come in next week.
Awesome.
To fight with us, to put us in our place.
I love Toby deeply, but he reads The Guardian, and it really skews his perceptions.
All right, so let's start with the Sona, because it finally happened on Thursday night. The obvious story wasn't about the president or the Sona at all. Well done to the EFF for stealing the headlines.
No, actually, let's just say well done to the media once again for turning the focus onto Julius instead of anything else that was actually said in Parliament. Really.
They're absolutely obsessed with him.
You keep giving oxygen to this particular fire, and then you're surprised at the point at which we're not able to have a reasonable debate on everything else that actually gets tackled. And this whole idea now of suddenly turning Parliament into an opportunity to actually hurl unsubstantiated allegations at members of Parliament simply because you've got parliamentary privilege. And what are the speaker and the whips of the party is actually doing to hold these people into order. It's appalling.
Hlanganisi, what do you think of what happened? Because I'm sure you watched it. Most of us, even if we didn't watch it, knew from the news what had gone down.
I was actually sitting in there when everything was happening on Thursday. So
you were there?
Yeah.
In Parliament?
I was supposed to actually join you guys here. And when Sia called me, I was like, I am literally just landed.
So what happened? I mean, from the point of view of the observer in the chamber, did we miss anything?
Not really. I think actually TV captures it much better. You that kind of gallery, you want to be able to see it on TV because you see a lot of angles. I worry about the sort of quality of debate, and I agree with Canton here. I worry about the quality of debate in South Africa as a whole. We, as a country, don't know how to speak to each other, but we also don't know how to disagree and disagree deeply without necessarily having to pull out gloves, you know, and kill each other. Or we could have like nice sparring matches afterwards as well. It doesn't really matter.
And as a result of that fear of conflict.
Yeah.
And by conflict, I mean debate, which is what civilized people do all over the world for thousands of years. You have arguments about the theory.
Stuff, yeah.
But the fact is we can never get to any level of serious depth, and we can never make positive and important change unless we debate these things at their fundamental level, start talking about facts, start comparing results. Because it's always just some superficial ideological thing.
It's the politics of spectacle, Gareth. It's really the politics of spectacle. Everyone, and you know what the problem is? And I think it's just an innate human thing. We actually enjoy spectacle because it's dramatic. It excites us. It's noisy, you know? It's something that we look at. And we may or may not agree on that, but South Africans enjoy spectacle. South Africans actually engage spectacle. I'll give you an example. For instance, and I think we're also falling into that trap right now because we've taken 2-3 minutes to speak about the spectacle and not actually the Sona, which actually I agree more than anything else was a very decent Sona considering the base the president was working from. This was Sona number 4. I was pleasantly surprised. I was pleasantly surprised with one. I think it's probably the most honest speech the president has given us outside of the sort of fancy language, the songs, the poems and everything else. And sort of ad-libbing humor, Sigela. I actually think it was a very honest Sona that said, hey guys, we have a lot of challenges in this country and these are the challenges. I also thought it was very much on pulse. It was on brand. It was, you know, there are challenges that South Africans are speaking about every single day, and South Africans almost felt like he wasn't listening. So for me, it was refreshing to have him give a sense of what is actually happening and not tell us about a new dawn, you know, and not tell us about the smart cities and the dream of a city. Tell us that we're in trouble and how much trouble we're in and how we can help work through that trouble. Of course, there's a lot of debate that can be had around the quality of the input itself, but also the quality of the information, the quality of the actual implementation and whether or not the ANC is the institution to take us through that. But I think for me, this was probably the most refreshing. It was honest and it told us, guys, we're in trouble.
But it was also just loaded with fantasy. Just pure wish
Which
thinking.
Part?
Well, the Lanceria Dream City, for a start. We know that's not going to... NHI.
Well, in fact, if we use the Lanceria Dream City as a very specific example, that's already been happening, but it hasn't been happening because of the president. You know, it's kind of like Al Gore invented the internet. So by the same token, you know, we've got this incubation center that has already been set up in the vicinity of Lanceria, pretty much. We've got Stain City, count that as part of the
Again,
the
certainly not the development that government put into play.
Absolutely not.
These are private enterprises.
Yes, but the point is, if you then take the view that Lanceria is supposed to become part of the Gautrain network as well, and it's supposed to extend from there, going further south down to Soweto eventually, on the assumption that you can get those basics put in place, this will organically develop. Now, my point very specifically is, do I want government actually building something like this? No, it's exactly like I don't want government building housing. What I want government to do is to actually put in place site and services and tell people, build your own houses. And they do.
Yeah.
They do it, you know, kind of, because Deep Sloot kind of emerged on that basis. I actually want to pick up on the point that you were raising around the spectacle. My very real sense right now, if you speak to people on the ground, you know, ordinary people on a day-to-day basis, there's actually the sense of tiredness around the spectacle. Yep. They do want those hard questions to be asked. They do want proper debate to actually be taking place. Mm-hmm. And this is my initial point around why I'm so frustrated with everyone actually focusing on the spectacle and on Malema and actually giving him that oxygen.
Yeah, I also just want to add something on that spectacle, because you very eloquently put the case that I think many people see it as an entertainment form.
Yep.
And I can't help thinking, Bulelo, you might have something to add here, because I always say that, you know, our sports teams, if they were doing better, they would take some of that need for spectacle away from politicians.
Yeah.
We don't really have celebrities in this country. And politicians think they're celebrities, which is why they dress up and they make a big deal of it. And actually, nobody really wants them front and center. The best politicians are the ones you don't even hear about.
100%.
In any situation, in any country, in any government, in any state.
Well, you know my take on that, what the role of a president should be, right? I've said it before, is the president should just be the best administrator in the country. When I think of all the best ones, I don't want an egomaniac in beautiful suits and beautiful shoes. I told you, me and Merkel married. Love her. Sit in the background, administrate, Machiavellian in the back, the idiosyncrasies. That's what I want you doing. I don't want to see you. But I think what we admire, right, we always talk of American politics. And really, it's as you've said, it's a politics of pageantry. And when we talk of the real politic of the day, we don't have this quality debate because we're obsessed about how loud Donald Trump is. I don't care. What is this politic? And we never get to that because, like you said, this facade, you know, and that's where we should always be most skeptical.
Like a show.
When there's a big show, you should always be more skeptical because what don't they want me to look at?
I have a feeling Canton's going to argue with you about Angela Merkel and the administration.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was like back.
All right, well, you go first.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Argue with him. Take him down if you disagree.
No, man, I like Angela Merkel, but she's not as sort of silent and backgroundy as she comes across. I think Angela Merkel is just strategic about how she exercises power. Hell, Angela Merkel facilitates her own sort of dialogue. She takes a mic from a facilitator. She'd probably take over Gareth's show right now because she wants to lead the conversation.
She's no wilting wallflower.
Yeah, no, yeah. There's a great conversation to be had around her work and her sort of her leadership style. I actually, and I think for me more than anything else, I think we really need to be honest with ourselves. What we're having here is a discussion about what the ideal political discussion ought to be, but actually everywhere in the world, politics are as degenerate as they are, right? And I'm sorry to say that, but it really comes across that way. So Elizabeth Warren, for instance, last night.
Oh, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Keep your powder dry.
Okay.
We'll get to that in a second. You know, we talk Bernie Sanders and
everyone
Michael
else. Yeah.
But I want to bring up something that illustrates, I think, this point about politics becoming, I like your word, degenerate. F.W. de Klerk, who hasn't been president for 25 years, and who's been attending the Sona uneventfully and usually not being paid particular attention to, suddenly, because it scores cheap political points, became the most important man in South Africa again this week, which is confounding. And of course, he didn't exactly help himself by being vague about whether or not he thought apartheid was a crime against humanity. But this should be a page 8 story for intellectuals to debate after the fact. He is not a man in political power at the moment. He doesn't have a constituency to speak of. He certainly doesn't represent the majority of people, let alone the majority of white people in this country. And it's interesting to me that we're more upset about the opinion of someone who's retired, outside of the system, has no hands on any controls or levers of any kind. And that the EFF were clever enough to see that this is a way to distract people from Cyril. And Cyril might be relieved by this, I think, because we won't be discussing in detail the breakdown of why his plans for the NHI or expropriation without compensation are a bad idea. Instead, we're looking at F.W. de Klerk. It feels like we're in a time warp. Am I wrong?
My frustration around the entire F.W. de Klerk thing is, again, the politics of distraction and our failure to go and focus on the stuff that the president actually said and what he didn't say. Now, I don't know if you remember, just prior to the State of the Nation address, I said I want only one thing from the president. in my blog, I just said, yeah. I want him to just do one thing. I need him to fix Metro Rail. That's the only thing that I want him to do. I've lowered my expectations right now.
Yes, directly about that.
Exactly. You know, I only want him to fix Metro Rail. Guess what? Okay, allocation of a couple of billion specifically for the purposes of fixing Metro Rail that came in. So is it a baby step that I'm actually comfortable with that is better than where we were the day before the State of the Nation address? Yeah, that's where we are. It's low expectations, but guess what? On that very specific point, the only thing that I wanted, there is a modicum of a promise of delivery that has actually taken place. Let's see whether it actually gets implemented, because we know that the ANC is big on making promises but low on making delivery. But as I said, you know, I'll go back to the point, you're starting on such a low base.
Yeah.
You know, let's see where
we've revised our expectations yeah. downward.
Now, if I look
into, like, they keep revising our growth downward
now,
with Moody's.
If you look in terms of the responses to the State of the Nation address, and, you know, again, forget all of the distraction about who's sleeping with whom, who's beating up whom. My point on the sleeping and beating up is very clear. Okay, I don't care who you're sleeping with or the number of people that you're sleeping with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's got nothing to do with me.
So if Stevens Bokgalapa had come in this morning, you would not be interested in his affair?
I would not. Absolutely not. Okay, I would be interested in the fact that you are damaging state property by having sex on the desk. That's a different matter. Okay, but the fact is, I don't care who you're sleeping with.
All right, fair
enough.
All right.
If you're beating up someone, I want people to lay charges.
Right. There is a system that can take care of that.
There's a system that takes care of that. I want to see people getting charged. If you are actually guilty of partner abuse, if you're guilty of any type of abuse, there's a criminal process. Let's go and lay charges. But going back to the responses, Ronald Amola actually did a very considered response yesterday in terms of unpacking what the president had to say, and I took some notes about that. And one of the things that he was doing was drawing a comparison between what Deng Xiaoping had to face at the point at which he took over in the post Mao era. And
he had to make some very serious ideological and practical decisions.
Yes,
and keep China ahead of well, first of all, to pull China out of what was essentially a kind of feudalism that had been the real material situation for many Chinese, but also to accommodate the free market into a system where ideologically they were opposed to it, in order to get to a point where they were competitive with the world.
Absolutely. And he said, you know, let me just take a look at my notes. He said
that history lesson brought to you. I just needed to give it a context.
Yeah, no, but he said something.
Most people are not as interested in Deng Xiaoping's policies as Canton and
especially 1969 reformist China.
Yes, but the important thing in terms of what Deng Xiaoping had to say was that he said it's okay to be rich.
Yes.
Which was the significant shift in terms of China. But he said when Xiaoping took over, China had to take pragmatic steps and open up the economy, deal decisively with corruption, allow for foreign direct investment in the economy, and open up for equity in some of the state-owned entities. And South Africa finds itself at a point where hard political choices and state-owned enterprises have to be made. In making those choices, the demands of the populace will not be met. And
so do you think this is the realization?
No, what I think is actually recognizing that this stuff is not binary. It's not black and white.
Yep.
This is a party that, if you consider right now that Ramaphosa's majority was what, 3 seats?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
3 votes at Nasrec.
Yeah, 3 votes at Nasrec. Now, in order to actually hold that entire mess together and not bring the entire edifice coming down. And don't get me wrong, I would rather the entire edifice collapsed so that the party actually split, because then Parliament will actually become the place where actually decisions get made.
I worry about that, Canton. Mm. I worry about sort of burning the whole thing and seeing it all collapse to the ground. We've actually seen the mess that has been coalition government, and I actually worry about, do we sacrifice service delivery at the altar, however poor
there's
it may
none
have
at
been
at the moment, don't you think?
Touche, but do you then have a situation where people can't even agree on budgets, for instance? The city of Johannesburg took, what, 6-7 months to pass a budget in their first year of coalition government.
Yeah.
That's 6-7 months of no allocation of money, 6-7 months of space picking up of trash when it was already ad hoc, right? And so for me, I worry about I think institutions like the ANC are institutions that are necessary until we can figure out what we do with South Africa going forward. And I think it's not necessarily processes that need to be mutually exclusive. And I wanted to actually bring this point up as well. I don't think the debate about apartheid needs to be mutually exclusive from the debate about what's happening with South Africa right now. Also considering the sort of substantial pain that apartheid caused in its entirety. De Klerk becomes important, an important figure, because De Klerk ultimately was positioned as the figure who represented some sort of Damascus moment for the apartheid government. Mm-hmm. 24 years later, 25 years later, I was 6 years old when he did that. 25 years later, De Klerk speaks a different language. Now, of course, this then brings into sharp focus a lot of the compromises that were made, be it during CODESA, be it, you know, a lot of the compromises that were made for South Africa to say, guys, let's figure it out. Let's all move together and let's hold.
And with the benefit
thing.
Of hindsight, there's a lot of revisionist history
exactly.
taking place.
But that's my specific point. Is he speaking a different language? No, he's not actually speaking a different language.
How so?
Hlanganisa, this entire premise around apartheid being a crime against humanity, it was a declaration by the United
sure.
Nations. But was that something that was actually agreed to at the time when they sat down in CODESA? Was that something that they put on the table as an opening statement that said, before we go forward, can we all agree that apartheid is a crime against humanity? No, it was not something that was actually on the table. He hasn't actually changed anything that he said in the past 30 years since he released Nelson Mandela and all of the other Rivonia trialists.
And
what has actually changed, though, is that we have people who are not aware of the fact that, unlike the Zimbabwe situation, basically, Smith was defeated militarily, which is what led to Lancaster House and the agreement that emerged from it. We had a negotiated settlement that came directly out of the fact that the Soviet Union had collapsed, the Soviet funding for the ANC in Lusaka and Dar es Salaam vanished overnight. Uh-huh. And guess what? The African leaders in those countries, and we're talking Kenneth Kaunda and we're talking Julius Nyerere, said, sorry, you know, we actually can't afford to pay to fund feeding 60,000 ANC cadres in this country. So you guys must actually sort yourselves out.
So they were between a rock and a hard place.
And at the same time, apartheid was collapsing based on the fact that on a per capita basis, it was the single biggest chunk of military spending in the entire world.
It was an economic failure, and the spending was in a national socialist sense.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it was.
Had crippled the economy.
Yes. Both sides were forced to the table. And what we had was a compromise.
Yeah.
It was a compromise where, and the point about compromise is that when everyone walks away from the table feeling that they've lost, you know, that actually we've won. But that was the situation that we ended up
with. So in other words, your argument is still for coalition governments and for compromise.
My argument is still for... Look, Hlanganisa, I'll say this much about coalition governments. If you look just in terms of the trajectory right now that the ANC is on, in terms of the percentage of votes, they've been losing every single election ever since Thabo Mbeki was forced out.
Uh-huh.
They were on an upward growth path under Thabo Mbeki, but they've been going backwards.
Sure.
2024 is the next election. Sorry, I'm getting...
2026, God, that's, it feels like it's so far in the future, but it's not.
No, all right, yes, okay. 2024. 2024, when the next election comes. If one looks at the trajectory right now in terms of the voting patterns, there's a very strong possibility that the ANC nationally is going to drop below 50%.
Sure.
So at that level, I'm saying that coalition governments are inevitable, and what we should be doing is to actually start training ourselves right now to think along those lines.
Sure.
And the reason why it failed in Johannesburg, by the way, is Johannesburg was not a coalition. Johannesburg, basically, the EFF allowed Mashaba to be elected mayor and then just withdrew from actually providing any sort of backup at that point.
Okay.
And I said from the get-go, what should have happened? Mashaba should have had conversations with the ANC at that point.
Yeah.
And actually cut the EFF out of the picture completely and said to those guys, listen, can we actually come up with a compromise budget out here?
Yeah.
With the cold light of transparency.
Yeah, when Mashaba was in here and we played out that interview on Friday last week, he's almost like anything but the ANC guy now. He's like, yeah, those are the people I won't talk to, you know. They are one step too corrupt.
And so that's my worry with sort of the absolute nature of our politics as yeah. well, right? Because our politics are absolute. And in fact, I think it's South African debate in general. It's very absolute. It's oksalayo or oksalayo. Mm. And there's a aichan, dikanto, aichan.
It's become in real life like
exactly,
it is on Twitter.
Exactly. And I think it's South African society in general, right? And our sort of amazing inability to have multiple complex discussions at the same time.
But South Africa, do you yeah. think that's really the case with average South Africans?
Yeah.
Because normal South Africans, I don't feel, are so intransigent. I feel like it's leaders and it's people on social media who are hiding behind often anonymity or bravado.
No, I think
in real life, people open the door and they hold it open for each other.
Sure.
In real life, we smile at each other in the streets.
Until we speak about land, then you have a different conversation.
Yes, but it's almost as if that's it's a bit of play acting. It's like, oh, now we got to go into our roles. So white people must play this role, black people must play this role.
Not really. You don't think so? No, I disagree
with
you.
Most people are not that interested in land, dude.
I am very interested in land, and I'm a normal South African. I think.
Do you have any?
No, unfortunately not. You know, I'd like a piece.
You can buy some. You know that you can buy some.
I am not. The credit level that the bank wants from me is not something that I want. And, and this is a debate that I always have with people. And I'm glad to have a land debate with anyone at any day. And I always say this. My father and I, for instance, we farm cattle back in Upington. I come from Upington in the Northern Cape.
Terrible place.
Now, yeah, it's an absolutely amazing place. It's much cleaner than all of Johannesburg.
It's because there's no one there.
No one wants to live there.
There's grapes, guys. Like, you guys, you know the most stressful thing when I moved to Joburg was?
Raisins, not grapes.
Grapes as well. Grapes, raisins, internationally exported. You know when I moved to Johannesburg? The most stressful thing, in fact, not even Johannesburg, I moved to Bloemfontein for all of my sins initially.
Sure.
Was the fact that you had to buy grapes at the store. It was the weirdest thing. I was like, why am I buying grapes?
So how you used to just pick them?
From a vineyard. But anyway, so I actually think that South Africans have topics and discussions that are deeply personal to them. And because they're deeply personal to them, the discussion is usually absolute.
Yes, but it's because often, and this is something we talk about regularly on the show, that it's about feelings, not thoughts. Now, let's just talk for a moment about Cyril's renewed enthusiasm for expropriation without compensation.
Yeah.
Right? Because this is something which has become a lot more theoretical for some people, and for others it's become a very practical thing.
Yeah.
Now, we have the banks keeping mum, largely, on this issue, because we've got a problem in this country. Most people are not absolute owners of their property.
Sure.
They have a bond on the property. Uh-huh. They bought the property. Now, if the banks are financing property that was stolen, then the banks are doing something immoral.
Sure.
And the banks are completely... they will be legally liable for trying to sell you something that, in inverted commas, was stolen.
Yeah.
Which means that all the people who stole, in inverted commas, the land will have to be compensated. The banks will have to be compensated by government because the law has changed. And the banks will then have to pay people for selling stolen goods. Right? In other words, I can claim back everything I've paid for my bond, which isn't paid off yet. And I could probably claim back the tax as well on that property from government.
That's an interesting discussion.
Which would mean that this is an untenable situation. That's if we just follow the law as it is at the moment.
Okay. What do you suggest we do? What do you think we should do?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I really don't know. Canton has some ideas around this. I know he's thought about it very long and hard. But
My point around it very specifically is that, remember, we have had an ongoing process of land restitution where land has actually been handed back. And what's the first thing that happens? People sell it. And then they move to the cities because they use it as a way of actually reclaiming stuff.
Capital.
Yeah, reclaiming. Yeah, because, and that's the pattern that actually takes place around the world. The specific point for me right now is not whether expropriation is actually the way that we should be going. It's whether expropriation without compensation is the way that we should be going. I believe that expropriation is a necessary part of every single society. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example,
you need to build an airport.
You need to build an airport. You need to build a freeway.
Sure.
Right now, what is the cost of actually paying to buy those properties and hand it back? And can the taxpayers actually afford it? And my point is that we can.
But okay, and Cyril did make one or two interesting concessions in the SONA, if anyone bothered to listen. And one of them was that the government is going to give up a huge amount of state-owned land. Which is a very big concession. I mean, the state is the biggest landowner in the country,
yes,
by a long way.
Absolutely.
And there's precious and valuable land which the state owns, which if he gives that over to people who are currently involved in land claim, for example, we could settle a vast majority of these claims.
But here's my thing, right? And I agree and I disagree at the same time. I think, of course, there's a mixed and a measured approach that we can take when it comes to land. The reason why, and I think I want the economics of land, I want to bring through that why my sort of economics is why I'm so passionate about it. Land ultimately is your biggest catalyst for wealth, property, because you ultimately are able to put land as collateral against anything that it is that you want to do. That's why people hold land for prospecting. That's why, for instance, families have
But you see, the important thing is the reason why land can be collateral is because you have tenure.
And property rights.
Yes. And if you remove property rights, which is what expropriation without compensation is, you remove the value. So your ability to then rely upon the fact that people are going to lend you money against it, it goes away.
Here's the thing, Canton, and this is why I disagree with you. We just built Waterfall right now, and Waterfall is a 99-year sort of occupancy. I'm not sure if I should call it a lease or occupancy.
Yeah, the Mia family were gifted that land, I think.
And you're guaranteed
in
just
the beginning of the 1900s.
Yeah. And so it's like a 99-year lease, 10 occupancy thing that comes up every single time. Now, that in itself, one, is not security of tenure, right? Because especially if you want to hand down something like land for generations to come, which is ultimately why people want to be able to buy land. Mm. But people are building massive houses there where you know that two generations from now, that could potentially change quite substantially. But people are actually still investing. So I don't think it's actually as absolute as we make it come across, that people are not going to
care
about
tenure. Well, that's true. That's true.
But,
I mean,
you see,
the crucial difference is that the Queen of England owns the whole of England.
Yes. And so everyone's buying land in England, right?
But the crucial
and
difference
continues to take levies off the people. People mustn't think the royal family is just having fun. They continue.
You had your go at the royal family.
Apologies.
Yeah, no, but guys, let's just use Waterfall as a very specific example. So let's say I've bought one of those Baldwin properties that are sitting on the corner of Waterfall right now. And on the assumption that I sell that to you in 5 years' time.
It actually happens to be a few kilometers from your house. A few meters even.
A few meters, yeah. It's literally on the other side of the Yuxke.
Yes.
But on the assumption that I buy one of those properties and I sell it in 5 years' time, the person who gets it from me then acquires a new 99-year lease. That's the way in which that is actually structured. So it actually rolls over in that way on an ongoing basis.
Sure, but and especially the discussion and debate that's been happening right now is not necessarily different to that, because the state would also be able to give you security of tenure.
No, but you see the difference.
Through those leases,
any freedom that someone gives you is not a freedom.
So I want to actually
freedom is something you take.
I disagree, and I'm going to come in there. So I want to actually just make this point around that. So The reason why land is such an emotive discussion and an emotive debate is the fact that land ultimately is the catalyst to economic sort of opportunity. Whether or not people make the desperate decision to sell the land once they get it back, because those are ultimately people that needed to either eat or needed to put children to school or whatever the case may be, and the sacrifices, right? And that's why it's such an emotive thing. But also, here's the other thing that makes the land question such an emotive one, and one I think we actually need to enter.
But nobody's arguing that it's not emotive.
No, of course, I completely agree. But I want to bring that emotive into the economics of it all, because ultimately, everyone knows the value of the piece of land, whether or not you hold it for 100 years, whether or not you hold it for 200 years or 7 generations or whatever the case may be, that piece of land becomes important. And I think that's why.
But if it's so important, why is the trend what Canton said earlier, that people who are given land or who are awarded land in land claims, most of the time, and we're talking not just a plurality, but a majority of the time in the 90%, sell the land.
Desperate.
And move. No. But solving people's poverty by using land is not necessarily the best way to solve people's poverty. We're living in a country where there's no economic growth, there are no job opportunities. So solving that with land seems to be like putting out a fire with gasoline.
You expect a rational sort of decision to come from desperate people.
I expect a rational decision from our president.
Yes, I do. And if that's unreasonable of me, and we should expect people to behave badly or to be irrational or to be emotional, then I don't think that we have a very high standard set for not only those people, but for ourselves. If you can't solve these things rationally, there's no point in trying to solve them, because all that people are going to do is act out like children.
So here's my thing, right? And I think I understand where you're coming from, and I always speak about this whole, we should never infantilize people who are necessarily poor, because that in itself is a very...
Or take away their agency and assume to speak on their behalf, which I and Canton don't have a mandate
for, as far as I know.
Nor do you, Mbule.
But guys, I just want to go back to that very specific point that I was raising. I don't have a problem with expropriation.
Sure.
And I'm saying, Clanisi, if that we have a situation where someone turns around and says, this was my ancestral land, I want it back. I'm saying, yes, by all means, give that person that land, but let the state actually pay for it. Because we can actually afford to do that. The social cost of actually allowing expropriation without compensation, which is legalized theft, happens at two levels. It tears our society apart. And the second thing...
Undermines property rights.
And Mike Pompeo was visiting the continent. And what's the first thing that he said? The big problem that we've got is that South Africa is moving down a destructive path in terms of property rights. Here's what happens if the U.S. now turns around.
Yeah, but I wouldn't agree with Mike Pompeo on anything.
The economic costs to us...
Sure.
On the event of Mike Pompeo then telling Trump, listen, we actually need to cut South Africa out of the African Growth Opportunity Act.
Something they're already doing.
No, they haven't.
They're considering that.
They're considering it, but they haven't done so yet.
Okay.
But if they do, the economic cost to us in terms of all of the industries right now that are able to export duty-free into the United States.
Ah, but Canton, that's imperial interference in our sovereignty, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
That's what the EFF is saying.
Absolutely, absolutely it is. And guess what? You know, we do that imperial interference in all of the countries that are part of
SADC. Let's have a numbers discussion about AGOA. I'm actually very keen on AGOA. I'm very keen on understanding AGOA. Sorry,
go on. No.
Let's have a numbers discussion on AGOA. If you do a comparison, and I think, Mulele, if you don't mind pulling up the numbers to check actually the net benefit of AGOA, you'll probably see that we haven't benefited as much from AGOA, considering that we're also taking a lot of American chicken that's dumped in South Africa that's probably killed off.
That's all well and good, but we've got to acknowledge that there are two factors for South Africa's future which supersede and are more powerful and more valuable to us than any of these other discussions, whether it's AGOA, property rights, or anything else. One is the free market, which if you don't respect the rules of the free market, even a great giant like China knows that you pay the price.
Yeah.
And the free market is also the greatest tool for the emancipation of
average
people.
Is it really free, Gareth, if someone tells you, if you don't do this,
that's not the free market.
That's not a free market, but that's literally what
the free
AGOA
market
is
me and
happening.
You deciding... Yeah. You want some land, and I'm saying, well, I'm prepared to sell it to you. And either you have some kind of historical claim to it, in which case you get government involved or not. But that's still the free market, which is what Canton was saying. So the free market's the one. The other one's technology. If we disrupt property as one of the tent pegs in the free market idea, we remove ourselves from the future of the world. We remove ourselves from the economy of the world. No one will respect us. Countries that have done this, look at what kind of... You want to talk about numbers. Look at Venezuela. Mm-hmm. I mean, choose your country. Wherever property rights are disrespected, look what happens.
Sure.
And we're sitting with growth at the moment of 0.7%. We were just revised down last week.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a a coincidence? That expropriation with compensation seems to be adding its value to
that? I don't want you to wave off the net effect of a go-up, because that's a linchpin and it's a very critical point that Canton actually brings up. Right?
And I just want to bring up some figures. I want to bring up figures at this point.
That's perfectly fine.
Okay, and one of the figures I want to bring up, okay, if you look in terms of our export partners right now, 9.5% of our exports go to China,
yeah,
followed by the US at 7.7%. Sure. Now, what's the difference between the two? We're actually exporting commodities to China.
Sure.
That's not what we're exporting to the US.
Okay.
Okay. We're actually exporting products that we are actually producing in this country. So it's manufactured goods. It's things like wine and all of that kind of stuff. The stuff that we are exporting to China is non-renewable.
Sure.
And that's eventually going to go.
Resources.
That's because of non-beneficiation.
Exactly.
Sure. Yeah.
In terms of what goes out to the U.S., that's stuff that actually is going to be sustaining us in the future as the mineral resources actually run out. And I'm saying if we're not taking steps right now to actually be protecting those markets, because our priorities there are the U.S., followed by Germany, followed by Japan, followed by India, in terms of places that we are currently exporting to. And I'm saying that a goa is actually flippin' important, 7.7%.
But that's a one-sided conversation, Canton, and you're using that quite sort of conveniently, right? I completely agree that the American market is a market that you want to trade in. Anyone who's serious about business wants to trade in China, wants to trade in the United States, wants to trade in India. That collectively is 3 billion people, and you want to be able to access that market.
Yes, but crucially, we have a trade surplus with the U.S.
Yeah,
and we have a trade deficit with China.
So you finished your point there. What are the costs?
What are the costs of that trade, right? And what are the concessions of that trade? If you look, for instance, the poultry market that's collapsed, and it collapsed quite spectacularly, I think a year or two ago, when sort of all of these enterprise, Rainbow, and all of these institutions won because the AGOA trade condition was, hey guys, let's see how we get the poultry in.
No, that is a complete and utter distortion, and I can highlight it by just one very simple point.
Okay, tell me more.
The fact that we have a trade surplus with the US. So no matter whether or not the poultry industry, as a very specific example, is one that is skewed in favor in the US, ultimately, because of the fact that we have, 7.7% of our exports going to the U.S. market, we have 6.6% of our imports coming from the U.S. Uh-huh. So in terms of our balance, we actually come out ahead versus our relationship with China, which is a parasitic relationship. 18.3% of our imports come from China, and 9.5% of our exports.
I'm afraid.
So those numbers are very
clear. As much as AGOA and poultry are fun, we're going to have to suspend this in favor of a discussion which I really want you to have. And listen, Hlangani said, at this point, we're going to have to get you back for like three more episodes of this, because it's definitely the kind of show I want to do. Let's just listen to Bernie and Mike Bloomberg. So for 1 week, we're not going to be talking about Donald Trump. We're going to be talking about the people who are vying for the top spot in the Democratic Party at the moment. It seems like Joe Biden has spectacularly imploded. Ooh. His campaign has been an utter disaster. Anyone want to disagree?
Nope.
No, it's embarrassing, actually.
So here's Bernie, who's the current front runner, an avowed communist, who's up against an avowed
Democratic socialist. No, don't call him a commie.
Well, potato, potato. So let's have a listen. So here it is. This is Bloomberg saying, what a wonderful country we have. The most well-known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. He's talking about Bernie. And Bernie goes, well, I work in Washington. And Bloomberg goes, that's the first problem. Smart. He's already showing that he can do the right dance on the debate stage. First appearance by Bloomberg.
What a wonderful country we have. The best known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. What I miss here?
Well, you'll miss that I work in Washington, house one.
That's the first problem.
Live in Burlington, house two.
That's good.
And like thousands of other Vermonters, I do have a subcap. Forgive me for that. But where is your home? Which tax haven do you have your home?
New York City, thank you very much. Yeah, well, and I pay all my home taxes.
This is great. Do you want to hear another one before we get into
it? Yeah, let's hear the other one.
So here's Bloomberg again hitting, I think, a home run by saying, I can't think of a way that would make it easier for Donald Trump to get reelected than listening to this conversation.
A large company, would you support what Senator Sanders is proposing?
Absolutely not. I can't think of a ways that would make it easier for Donald Trump to get reelected than listening to this conversation. It's ridiculous. We're not going to throw out capitalism. We tried that. Other countries tried that. It was called communism, and it just didn't work.
Oh. And Elizabeth Warren jumped in there. Now, you wanted to talk about Elizabeth Warren, so bring in what you thought from her performance at the debate last night.
I actually saw a really cool video of someone mashing up. TikTok, by the way, is the coolest thing ever. I just discovered TikTok or really like started taking it seriously, and I love what the kids are doing with it. And someone made a mixtape of Elizabeth Warren burning Bloomberg.
Let me see if I can find it.
We'll put that up.
Yeah, that's actually a really cool video that they were doing there. American politics are messy. We always think our politics are messy. American politics are messier, if not messiest. I don't know. So I'm very keen about, and when I look at the politics of a country, I always look at what it is to be issue-based. What are the issues that come up, you know? The Democratic primary has been really messy. From Ohio, the coin toss to, you know, to last night's debate, or this morning rather, for on our spectrum. I really don't know what's happening, and I really want to get an understanding of what are the issues that they're actually debating. Because here's the thing, and I worry about that South African politics are degenerating into the same space. We're having a lot of personal discussions, and these are people within the same party, and no one's really saying, outside of Bernie, and I think this is why Bernie sort of has some sort of a clear lead amongst others, is because we actually understand Bernie's platform. Warren, for instance, last night did a whole burn.
Well, Bernie's a true believer. Like he has been consistent
over
the years.
His messaging has been consistent, right. And you're able to understand what it is that he's offering Americans. Elizabeth Warren, on the other hand,
she's just dishonest.
I was about to say
she pretended to be a Native American for most of her adult life.
It was a very weird exercise. I'm not sure why Americans do that. But
well, I'll tell you why, because identity politics have become such a powerful playing card.
Sure.
That if you can't claim some sort of marginalized identity,
you lose a constituency
in the Democratic Party. Yeah, you don't matter anymore, which is why it's important for people like Jeremy Corbyn in the UK to go up and say before an election, hi, I'm Jeremy Corbyn and my pronouns are him and his. It's ludicrous. It's almost religiosity.
Yeah.
That has been changed. I'm Jeremy Corbyn, my pronouns are has and been.
Wow.
Well, it's a religion now. And what you have to do in identity politics now is you have to go up and tell your sob story about how you had it hard once, you had it tough, and you come from this background, and people are meant to care. And then that's how you purge, and you start your conversation, and
except
then you go into a ritual confession.
I think that people are tired of it. The point that Clagalisa is making is exactly the same problem that we have out here, because Warren's opening statement was to attack Bloomberg
for being a billionaire
and for stuff that he purportedly said about women. It's exactly going down the same playbook,
which is what she did to Bernie a few weeks ago.
And guess what, the response in terms of that is that people actually don't care. We want to know how you're going to fix the country, how you're going to address the very specific problems that we've got, and there are legal processes to sort out the other stuff.
Can I just ask you something about that quickly, and I'd love any of you to jump in here on this. What is it about people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders in the case of the American election, that it seems to me they're more obsessed with the politics of envy? I mean, we already have a word for this. It's called envy when it comes to someone like Bloomberg or someone like Trump or even someone like Buttigieg, because they were all complaining about how he had these wine cave events with billionaires who are some of his donors. They seem to be more obsessed with what they're missing out on than what they want to do. What is that? This resentment. Where does that come from? Anybody want to have a go at that?
I suspect that they've been advised based on the people that are in their circles, which is not necessarily the smartest way that one needs to end up going. And I think one of the interesting things that Trump actually does is that a lot of his messaging is based on research in terms of what's actually going to most resonate with the audience. So it's stuff that he keeps very simple. It's Make America Great Again. It's Build the Wall. It's, you know, let's toss out the Muslims. Very basic, specific stuff that resonates with a sufficient body of his audience to be able to gain him traction.
Sure.
The Democrats are not doing that kind of stuff. They're actually trying to focus on saying how bad other people are, as opposed to stuff that they're actually going to.
I think it's tiered. I think it's tiered. I agree and disagree at the same time. I think it's tiered, Gareth, and I want to actually link the whole concept of billionaires and the politics of identity, because I think there's a link there. So the Democratic Party speaks to largely an ethnic minority in the United States, or at least they try to, because, you know, the Make America Great Again and kick out all of the Muslims is very much a white right message in the United States, and Trump does that quite spectacularly. And so that's why understanding identity is a very important exercise, because ultimately, and I think it's a thing across the world, in minorities, or in our case majorities, where people were oppressed, usually the identity comes with that, right? And so that identity is actually quite closely linked to your economic opportunities and to your economic fortunes as well. So you can't separate the two. Anyone who wants to lead the Democratic Party into an election and actually try to defeat Donald Trump must speak that language, because once they do that, they speak to a couple of constituencies.
But they all do. Sure. I mean, to their credit, even Biden and Klobuchar.
Look, I just want to go. I want to go back. Let's just
finish this point, Gavin.
Sure, go for it.
And so those politics are actually quite closely linked with each other, and I think it makes sense politically and strategically for any sort of Democratic sort of person to actually have that conversation. But also, that's why the refrain of the billionaires is so important, because ultimately you're able to then create an enemy for the minorities or the ethnic minorities that you're speaking to. Donald Trump has created the enemy as the Mexicans. Donald Trump is the enemy of, from Donald Trump is the Muslims, you know. It's everyone, Iraqi, anyone who wears a burqa is an enemy, and they're able to do that quite successfully.
Certainly killing lesser than Obama did.
Exactly, of course, touche, right?
So the Democrats, it's all about play acting.
Yeah.
And with the Republicans, it's also about play acting when you're looking for votes.
Yeah.
But then when it comes to practice, the one carries on play acting and the other one actually does.
Look, I've actually got to disagree with this point that you're raising, Manganese. And the very specific example that I'll use as a rebuttal was Barack Obama.
Mm.
Because Barack Obama's message was very clear, okay? It was just three
words. Wasn't identitarian.
It was yes, we can.
Sure.
And every single bit of messaging that Obama went through was always based on what can we do together. There was never a point of division actually creeping in any of Obama's speeches. To this day, everything speaks to common purpose. And guess what? That's something that Republicans and Democrats were both able to buy into. People actually get that type of messaging. Remember that you had an overwhelming majority of people who voted for Trump who voted for Obama.
Yeah.
So it wasn't on the basis of...
So we can't demonize these people as Obama voters and then like them as Trump voters, or vice versa.
So
here's the interesting thing, right? Is in 2008, Obama ran against McCain, the late McCain.
Yeah.
McCain's platform was not a right-wing platform. McCain's platform was not a platform that sort of appealed to the base instinct of the white right in the United States. McCain's platform was actually, you know, it was very much a measured approach to say, we need to make America... this way. We need to set up America in this specific way, and these are the ways we're going to do it, and we're going to bring prosperity for everyone, which was the same message as Barack Obama's. Mm. Barack Obama had a kick-ass campaign. I actually know the guy who designed the digital campaigns, a guy called Harper Reed, absolutely smart, one of the sort of pioneers of machine learning, right? So Barack Obama out-sprinted John McCain purely because on the messaging platform, they spoke the same language. We want to build a prosperous America. But what Obama did substantially better than McCain was the fact that he was able to speak to young people. He knew how to get to their phones. He knew how to get to their
social
media.
But he was also
media.
A better performer.
He was a better performer, and he was a better statesman, you know? He's tall, he's lanky.
Yeah, sure.
I've met the man. He's shorter than me.
But this is a bit of a history lesson with respect. I want to know how this impacts, and we've only got a few minutes left, so I've got to cut to the chase on this.
Sorry.
So we've got Bloomberg, and we've got Sanders, and we've got Biden floundering. Let's be serious. Elizabeth Warren, no chance that she's going to be the nominee. there's no chance that Pete Buttigieg is going to be the nominee, no matter how many delegates he got in New Hampshire. There's no chance that Amy Klobuchar is going to suddenly become the nominee. So what do we got? We got Sanders, we got maybe a Biden, and we got Bloomberg. Which would be the best for America, which would be the best for Trump, and which would be the best for the Democratic Party? Because all three of those answers are different.
Yes, but that's remember that the ultimate question that we need to ask is which of those candidates is most likely to have a chance against Trump in terms of beating him. And the point that I made for the past couple of weeks, Gareth, is right now I think that Sanders is the only person who has a message that is different enough from what Trump is actually putting out to actually gain traction with a significant body of voters.
And in that, on that note, the New Hampshire primaries were a particularly interesting one because against Hillary, Bernie managed to get 60% of the vote in New Hampshire. Against all of these others, this mess that he's in at the moment, without Bloomberg being part of it at that point, he only got 25, 26%. That's either because of low turnout, which we know was a problem.
New Hampshire is also quite a small state.
It is a small, but it's important for Bernie because it's right next door to his home state. Yeah. And if Bernie doesn't start strong in New Hampshire, I'm afraid something in the 20s isn't starting strong. We're looking at a very watered down Democratic race here.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very easy for Donald Trump to clobber all of these people. He got, in a New Hampshire primary he wasn't even taking part in, over 100,000 people pitched up and wrote him down on the polls. Now, that's way more than the votes Bernie got as the winner in New Hampshire for the Democrats.
Well, I want to circle back to a theme that Mhlanganisi brought up at the beginning, is the degeneration of politics. And I know, once again, it goes back to pageantry. It worries me that we're excited about Bloomberg becoming a politician because politics is a real thing. He's not a politician. And it worries me
Bernie says, what this shows is that if you are a billionaire, you can buy your election.
Bolelo, I have to point out that Trump is not a politician.
No, I agree, which is the degeneration of politics. Is we're so excited about billionaires being the most important politician in the world. That is a worrying, worrying place.
I just think that it's better than career politicians who definitely let us down.
Yeah, I actually want to agree with you there. I think something worries me when someone has done nothing other than politics in their lives, right? I worry about that. But in terms of your questions, Gareth, just quickly,
Thank you for answering my questions. I can't get these two to answer thing.
I answered your question, like a politician. So question number one, even if Bernie scrapes through the Democratic primary, that's perfectly fine. The actual race that matters is the United States election into the White House. And I think I agree with Canton here. Bernie has a clear, succinct message that can resonate. And of course, and here's the thing we've seen with the Democratic Party, especially with the election of Barack Obama, for instance, is once a candidate gets through the primaries, they have to rally behind that
person.
You think
he'll be able to get the vast majority of moderates, the kind of people who Canton was pointing out voted for both Trump and for Barack Obama? Do you think that those people are going to vote for an octogenarian socialist?
But those people don't actually...
Who's never proposed...
He's a septuagenarian, isn't he?
Well, he's about to become an octogenarian. Yeah. He will be if he goes into office. Mm. But who has never actually managed to achieve any of his own authored legislation to be passed in any which way. I think the two things Bernie's got right is he got a post office renamed in Vermont once, and he's managed to do some kind of decorative thing in terms of, I think it was street lights or something. These are the two things that this man, in how many, you talk about politicians, he's been in politics his whole life.
His whole life,
He's never had a job outside of politics.
He's
lived off the state.
So if I had to choose, and once again, this is very much a subjective thing, and that's fine. I'm very subjective when it comes to Bernie's politics. If I had to choose between Bloomberg, Stop and Frisk New York, and Bernie,
lowered crime rates, made African American communities safer. That guy.
No. Stop and Frisk, and so that's the thing.
African American communities safer. Lowered the crime rate.
But if you're working around it, I'll disagree with you, and I disagree with you completely here, Gareth. That guy who made African American communities safer. You don't have African Americans walking around because they're scared of being stopped and frisked, then they're having a different conversation. Safer because we're not walking around.
So you don't don't mind as long as it looks nice.
No, it doesn't matter if people are being robbed. No,
if there's crime in black neighborhoods, that's fine by you as long as you don't stop and frisk them.
Guys, I just want I need to climb in at this point, and I've got to say two things out here. The one is, you're right, it is effective. But it's effective because it's repression.
Yes.
And my point is, do I want to make that trade-off in terms of stop and frisk versus my personal liberty? And the answer for me very clearly is no.
Yes, it is effective.
Fair point. Yeah. But it's effective in exactly the same way that apartheid was able to keep crime levels down.
Yeah.
Because they would blitz some black people left, right, and center.
Yeah. I want to just finish. Yeah. We keep interrupting you. Finish your point, though, about if it's Bernie versus Bloomberg. Yeah.
So if it's Bernie versus Bloomberg, I'll take Bernie any day because Bernie ultimately has the clearest message amongst them all. And by the way, I actually don't think the any voter is rational, and let alone the American voter. American voters very much vote in haphazard patterns. They took the Democrats out of the upper house, and then next thing they removed the sort of Republicans in the lower house. So those voting patterns, I wouldn't trust American voting data. Otherwise, if we trusted American voting data,
we would have
seen
predicted Trump, and
exactly,
nobody did.
And no one predicted Trump.
I did too, but here's the fact. I'm going to make another prediction.
Yeah,
I reckon that with all of this going on, what's likely to happen is that Bernie is going to be the front runner, which would be to both of your likings and to yours
also.
All right, so even Bulelo,
I think Bernie would be better for South Africa than Bloomberg.
Okay, so here's Bernie, and we know that he hasn't really got a foreign policy other than to just reduce the American presence all over the world and kind of close down any need for... Maybe they'll even be open.
He's not an imperialist.
Trump doesn't have a foreign policy either.
Sure, Trump doesn't. He's totally pragmatic.
No, no, Trump does have a foreign policy. It's suck up to the Saudis.
Okay.
That's a good point, too. However, we digress. Here's what's going to happen, in my humble opinion. I reckon that what's going to happen is Bernie is going to force a lot of people who are moderates, centrists, people who know what America stands for, free market, opportunity, all that stuff. It's going to force them to hold their nose and vote for Trump. And I reckon this could be the ultimate... This is going to be the moment where America gets to say we're all for this and we're not at all for that. And where Trump could win like 40 states. He won't get California, maybe. He won't get New York. He won't get some of the Northeast. But otherwise, he'll clean up. And it will be a clobbering. And the Democrats will have to go back home and rebuild their party and throw out things that didn't appeal to people, whether it's socialism, identitarianism, minority stuff, whether it's majority stuff, whether it's economic policy. They're going to have to go and look at themselves carefully in the mirror, because it's going to be a statement by the American people in a direction, and it's going to be unanimous, virtually. Now, that could be scary.
Once again, you sort of work from a base that American voters are rational. American voters are not
rational. No voters are rational.
Touché. That's
we are
important.
Not. We're certainly not in this country.
I actually think the whole identitarianism, and I actually want to sort of weigh into that, the identitarianism politics is a response to Trump politics, right?
No, it was there before. Obama was using this stuff to his advantage.
It was, but it wasn't as pronounced as it is now, right? You have a situation where communities are now saying, hey, man, a Hispanic community in this district, and that's why, for instance, you saw someone like OAC. So OAC,
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, AOC. Yeah. So how AOC comes up is
she auditioned for the role and she won what they would have called in the UK what do they call those districts where people really don't run because there are only a few votes that separate people.
Boroughs,
like a rotten borough.
Basically, the Republicans didn't field a candidate.
They didn't field.
Correct. Yes. So she won by default.
And ditto for Rashida Tlaib as well.
Yeah, they're both actresses.
Yes.
They are.
So they didn't actually have to campaign.
She was a waitress and she got picked. She got auditioned and picked for the role.
Guys, I just want to swing around though on a final point I want to make, because we are out of time.
Yeah.
And the piece that I wrote on Monday last week, where I said that the unraveling of the European Union begins today. And the very specific point that I was making there was, firstly, you had Merkel's successor in Kramp-Karrenbauer, who was supposed to be taking over as leader of the CDU-CSU, and she has now stepped down. And the, And the reason why she stepped down is because they took a trouncing in a very specific constituency based on the fact that the AFD, which is the purportedly right-wing party in Germany, effectively became kingmakers in a very specific election. And going back to Mhlanganisi's point earlier on about, you know, people saying, oh, Mashaba saying anyone but the ANC. That's exactly the approach that German parties have been taken so far in terms of the AFD. Mm-hmm. And guess what? They are now in a situation where they are forced to deal with the AFD.
Because voters are actually correcting them.
And that's why we can't afford to actually have this mindset that says we are not prepared to talk to other people.
I must thank Mhlanganisi for adding incredibly valuable input today, because this is precisely what we've had, is a varying degree of opinions
but
from
he
left
and I agree
right.
on Sanders, which is great.
Well, this is terrific, but I do love the fact that there's been constructive discussion today. Too often this burning platform has been really me and Canton agreeing with each other and then rarely disagreeing occasionally, but also having people come in who are not necessarily imbued with the courage to argue and to contest their point of view. So thank you all, gentlemen. Mhlanganisi, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much,
Mbulelo. And thank you, Canton. That is the Burning Platform for today. It's brought to you by Nando's. Thank you all very, very much. It's a home run, and you can listen to the whole thing from beginning to end in the podcast. We will make sure it's up ASAP for you. Right now, it is time for us to find out about the next in our series on Stop to Start, which is a brilliant campaign which ABSA are running at the moment. Many South Africans have a loved one whose life has been impacted by sexual or gender-based violence. It makes it a cause really close to our hearts. And everybody talks about the women in these situations, quite rightly, because they are the victims. But the men are the perpetrators in many of these situations, the vast majority. So what do we do about it? We need male role models. We need to teach men how to be men. We need to teach them what it is to be a good man, to lead, to help, to secure, to build, and to grow. And in the light of all of this going on in South Africa, ABSA have done something quite brave. They've brought on something called Stop to Start with Charlie Peterson, someone from Bloemfontein who I've known for a long time, who's been an absolute passionate advocate for the role of men in society in a positive sense. And he has put together these incredible workshops for 1,000 young men in South Africa who've been positively impacted by the initiative, proving that ABSA is actually what they say they are, a purpose-led organization. We spoke to key stakeholders in Soweto, and we were at the Dobsonville Stadium, and we got to speak to Sazini Mojapelo, who is the managing executive for ABSA Corporate Citizenship and Community Investment, about Stop to Start. Take a listen to this.
This is CliffCentral.com.
Sazini, we live in a country where if you're a boy, the message you're getting is that you're trash. The message you're getting is that you're responsible for all the violence in society, that you're responsible for only the bad things, that there are few things that you can do that aren't going to have a negative impact. And that's obviously wrong. We know it's wrong. Mm. And there are lots of boys who are looking for guidance. It's brave of ABSA to be involved in this. How did it all start?
Hi, Gareth. It's good to see you.
And you.
I was just saying earlier that one of the things my role in the bank is to look at how we create a meaningful impact. And when we were at the CASP or the breaking point around sexual and gender-based violence with a student at UCT, and I think it just brought matters to a head. And a strong message was sent out. I think we're actually the only corporate where we had the chairman and the CEO speak out against it. And that was us taking a stand as a large corporate, as a bank, and saying, actually, we condemn this behavior. Every person should feel safe, and particularly the way it happened. And what then the task that was then put forward was, can you develop something that is impactful and can make a meaningful impact in our communities? And within that, to try and make sure that in the development of such an initiative, it's sustainable and it deals with the real issues that we should be focusing on. To your point, the messages that young men are bombarded with are not positive messaging. Mm. It's very negative messaging.
And look, we've got to admit in this country, we do have a major problem. Men are not the best men they could be in very many situations. And that's how we have this terrible gender-based violence problem, but the way that, you guys are getting involved is unexpected. A lot of people would say, why would a bank, and I'm sure this happens with you all the time because you come from the citizenship role and you're trying to find ways to make a meaningful impact and to improve society, and sometimes the commercial interests trump that. How did you win over in this respect the board, the people who might think, you know, ordinary ABSA consumers and customers who think, well, why don't they tell us about products instead? How do you win that battle?
I think for this particular instance, it was unique because the entire country was outraged. There were many marches that were done with people dressed in black saying stop. So our role has always been where we look at how we play a shaping role in society. And a big part of our DNA as a bank, and even if you look into our history, has always been making a positive impact in our communities. And we've always taken the view that we want to be an active force for good. And when something like this happens, you don't keep quiet. We take our role in society quite seriously. And maybe if I can just unwind, the reason why my title in the bank is Head of Corporate Citizenship and Community Investments, it's because we look at our role as a corporate citizen in the country, and we take it quite seriously. And if you think what citizens' role is, should be, and the rights you have, is what we see ourselves as, and therefore it, it expands beyond just providing a service to our customers and clients, but actually taking on a social responsibility to making our country grow, drive social cohesion, social justice, and we're invested in that space. I must say it was not difficult at all. It actually was a request from board to say, what are we doing? If we say
they don't see you as a dangerous activist, they have to keep...
No, they actually give me wings to fly.
That's fantastic.
And I attribute it to the chairman, Wendy Lucas Bull, who takes her role as a chair for such a bank as important and entrenched in our societies and how systemic we are and the impact we can have. And I think she's had that kind of legacy if you look at her role in First Rand as well, where she drives transformation, social impact and change.
Well, it's obviously helpful that you also have a history and you're a sought-after speaker yourself in terms of, you know, conceptualizing, developing, implementing these kinds of programs. But it is gratifying to see on the faces of these young men here that they're taking it in. They're doing this in an environment where it's fun. They can meet some of their heroes. You can tie together the value of the sponsorship that you guys have with the Premiership, for example, with the fact that young men are looking for role models and that some of the time their sports heroes are their role models. They're likelier to listen to them than they are to me or to you or to somebody else who might have, you know, some strong societal value to impart, but they're not really listening some of the time. And then for them, as David Wingfield said just a minute ago, to hold each other accountable. This is a male bonding session, effectively. Yeah. I mean, that's quite extraordinary. You don't see this often.
And I think I would say that the success or the thinking behind it is brought together by David being specialist in the marketing, branding, and corporate and sponsorships space, and my expertise in community investments, development, and change. If you put us in the same room, invariably we'll bring our different expertise to bear. I will talk to how men need to speak to boys, and he'll say the best way to do that and bring that to life in an environment that is non-threatening is let's use our sponsorship collateral. Similarly to our hashtag stop campaign, I will bring the theory behind it and its importance and its long-term impact. They'll say the best way to bring this to life is running a campaign that communicates the following and reaches the masses this way. So I think it's more not so much just my expertise alone, but I think the work of the team bringing these kind of initiatives to life is a combination of the different expertise around the table.
You have kids?
Three. Two boys.
Two boys and one girl.
One girl.
So what kind of a world would you like your boys to grow up in and lead and be examples of? What kind of a world would you like them to possess one day?
So you see, for me, these kind of initiatives become very personal. And when I look at how, for my boys, the access and the privilege they have, the way they are raised, the way the schools teach them, they have positive role modeling. they will tell me stuff about themselves that I'm not even aware of. But the school is providing that enabling environment. And if I look then to 90% of the population, 90% of the boys who are in disadvantaged communities, they don't have that kind of access. So if you just look at the access that my boys have and what the rest don't have, how do we bridge the divide? It's through these kind of initiatives where we then empower the young man, empower the boy to make the decisions that inform how they grow up in the next generation. I look at how my boys actually are more empowered about their rights and what is right and wrong and how they treat their sister, how they treat their mother. Yeah. And they have that not only from home, but the socialization process or the system around them enables them to do that. And that's access and privilege. That in most of our communities, if you get into the township and rural areas, they don't have that. The families are not well put together. Fathers may be present, but they can be absent as well, even if they're there. And all they seek to do is to provide. But that ability to then do the positive role modeling, they look for it elsewhere.
Yeah.
So these kind of initiatives, then even if it's just a seed that is planted, they will remember it. And I think that's where we pitched this kind of our intervention, not with men, but with a boy child,
mm-hmm.
and started our conversations there. And they are conversations that should be ongoing. So we are looking at how this is a pilot, but how we actually roll it out more sustainably and create a program. One of my big things is to always work to enable government and the departments to do things better.
Right.
And that's our role in private-public partnerships. So we do the proof of concept, and then I go and have the conversation with Panyaza. Say, can we do this and make it roll out? Find civil society organizations like the one we're working with now, and with the corporate muscle that we have, and then work with government to create a more sustainable impact.
Yeah, I met Charlie Peterson a while ago, and I've been aware of him because we did a program in Bloemfontein a long time ago, about 5 years ago. And he has really done an incredible job of going into terrain that hasn't been explored very much in this country. I know how much you've done in terms of women entrepreneurship and that kind of thing in your own career. And people often think that it has to be one or the other.
Mm-mm.
But actually, we should be growing our young men and young women together. And you brought up your daughter as well. The kind of world that you want her to live in and the kind of men you'd like her to interact with is also, that's a motivating force individually for you about why you'd want to get involved in something like this. And the way that men interact with women in this country, there's a lot that we can learn.
I think that's exactly the point. And some of the things that I've struggled with in my role in APSA is how there's so much attention paid to the girl child. And yes, I understand the inequality, but the inequality is at a certain generation level, not with the girl child at the moment. They are very empowered, and we've created that enabling environment for them.
Which is
but
good.
I'm concerned it's to the disadvantage of the boy child. So more investment needs to go in there. But if I look at how my daughter views life, it's similar to her mom, because she role models, and my boys role model my husband, and they also learn beyond that. But if we then expand it into what we can do as a corporate citizen, as a bank, is to actually try and drive those positive messaging and impact and role modeling more broadly beyond just the nuclear family. And I think with some of the learnings and academic experience I've had, what I studied, it's more around looking at how you start with your nuclear family and socialize out into your community and the next sphere of influence and how you form your identities. These kind of initiatives are a big part of that, in how you form your identity.
Absa, you guys are not shouting your name all over the place, so I'm going to do it for you, but you've been involved in a number of scholarships. There is an employment program that's kicking off soon with the presidency, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on. Do you want to just give us a brief overview of what's going on with the scholarships?
I think we've actually been involved in the scholarship initiative for quite a long time now. And it was once again a response to where we are an active force for good. And when the Fees Must Fall movement was happening, we said we cannot actually be looking at our resources in the manner that we do. Let's divert funding into universities. We identified 21 universities across the country. And decided to be audacious about our goals and started with 3,000 young people in 21 universities. And we said we're taking them back to school because most are financially excluded, not academically excluded. And we're a financial services organization. Literally, we can try and divert some of our resources towards supporting these young people. And we've supported to date maybe over 10,000. And we continue to do so. We just did another investment now, which is quite big. But the difference with this one, we said, let us look at postgraduate diplomas and certificates, because what we need as a country are skills. We support degrees, yes, but the young person who's moving from a degree and getting a certification in digital coding is actually not funded.
Sure, and it's probably more valuable in
and
the long term.
It's what we need.
It's one of the careers of the future, as opposed to, you know, we don't actually need a whole lot more lawyers.
No. Sorry to say.
Yeah, I'm sorry too. That's what I studied.
But we then had the conversations with UCT, for example, with WITS, and they've developed these different diplomas and certifications, how to do financial analysis and coding, how to do digital finance. And we said we want to support young people in that, and they are financially excluded.
Well, I don't know if you're going to go and kick a ball around later. I don't know if you've got any skills in that department. I definitely don't.
Neither do I.
But we've got Teko Modise, Spiwa Chabalala coming. These are guys who... these young men look up to. It's going to be a fun day. It's
and
not
my young
all.
Boys look up to them too.
Yeah, well, who doesn't in this country? These are our heroes. The sports stars in this country are the people who I think a lot of young men idolize.
Mm.
But it's a fun day. It's not all, you know, we hear these guys up behind us now.
It's a full day program, yeah?
Rejection. And I think this is this is something that not just these young men, but all of us men struggle with.
Yes.
So I'm kind of listening with half an ear. But well done on your involvement in this. And thank you for kicking off a program that's going to go far beyond today. And that will start to trickle into communities and start making a real difference for so many young men. And then obviously the young women they interact with
they
too.
They benefit.
Damn right. It's terrific. Thank you, Sazine.
Awesome. Thanks,
nice
Gareth.
Nice to see you.
This is CliffCentral.com.